Launch all sequence has started.
Crew one for all.
Welcome to Moon Snacks, the podcast where we get together with creative, thoughtful leaders who share their own experience about life and the world of work through the movies.
If they were going to be sent to the moon and only had three movies to take with them, what three movies would those be?
And it's wonderful to be back here with you again, Jessica.
And I feel like you and I, when we first met, really bonded over stories and movies, and we're just basically continuing that tradition.
It's about stories, right?
All about stories.
Al Zaytoun, I have to say, is a longtime friend and colleague. He is a leader in really working programs and projects. He's an author of several books in terms of how do you approach project management and program management from the standpoint of excellence. This is one of the days I live for. Why do you laugh when I say things like that?
You never change. You never change. You know, from our days of playing with apps on the phone all the way across our life's journey, right? Walking on the beach in Dubai.
You put a smile on my face. I was trying to explain, Jessica, in a nutshell, you're a thought leader. You're a provoker of ideas. And I like that. So it puts me in a good spirit. But that's definitely an honor to have... Longtime friend and colleague, Al Zaytoun, let me tell you.
Can I ask a question, too, for those listeners like me who are not really in the business or corporate world? What is a thought leader? Because I know Al is described as one.
To me, a thought leader is someone who basically shakes up and creates new insights. So an insight is a new idea, a new thought, maybe seeing the same thing in a different way. Al's one of those people who make you see what he's talking about in new ways, in new light.
Before we send you to the moon, can you tell us a little bit in your own words about who you are and what you do?
I'm a global guy who's an extremely passionate about learning. So I think when Ed says thought leader, it's really because I'm a learner at heart. And I truly, truly love to learn in so many different ways. I'm a huge global passionate learner.
Do you know, you two have that in common, I think, both you and Ed. And I'm curious, over the years of you working in knowledge management and thought leadership and with businesses, have things changed? Has there been radical shifts that you've seen? And what does the landscape look like now?
To me, what has dramatically shifted is because we have to think about what our value proposition is in the future, the next generations, including the very brand new one that was born even, you know, after 2010, that's really, I mean, those are going to be the true leaders that capitalize on the shifts that have happened, right? So the shifts are technology, of course. We all know it and you all see the impact of it. Globalization has been a very different shift because to a great extent, the kind of resources and planet we live on and the gaps that continue to exist around the, you know, nature and climate and resources and so forth, right? So there have been so many shifts all coming together, in my opinion. But I think the biggest thing, I'm a huge fan of technology, is the access to massive, now not just information, but really themes, trends, articulated opinions that you can build on, that you can enhance the speed by which you make decisions. It's a very different world. We're not researching and for X number of weeks or months before we are at a place to make some conclusion about some next steps. I love that. So the pace is very different and it could be very good for humanity if used the right way.
You know, we go back to project management, decades, and there was a notion, certainly over 20 years ago, I think there was the notion that, you know, it's about execution. It's about following a process and staying on the line. So I think that's the change. You can't just follow a script over and over and over again.
I think the future is about experience, right? So it's really about our experience around the execution and the outcomes of the execution. So my last book, I was fortunate enough it's a 2024 book, but it came out a couple of months early. It's program management. It's about, you know, going beyond project management to enable value-driven change, right? So this is the one word that's really important, value-driven, right? So what does that really, truly mean? And my next one, I'm hopeful this year, is about the culture. And it's about really how the experience, what I call experience-driven culture, right? How do you really create an experience out of the work that's being delivered in organizations and across society, right? Experience not just for customers and partners and users, but the employees, the society, the at large and so forth, right? What does that really mean in terms of how that affects quality of lives, ways of working, you name it, right? So it's not really focusing so much on initiatives and projects and portfolios, but it builds on that and goes more to that larger culture. I think it's to me, it's I'm fascinated by culture.
So you are an ideal person, clearly self-disciplined with all the tools you need to survive on the moon. And I'm also looking forward, you're kind of thought leaders are kind of the modern day philosophers in a way. So I'm looking forward to seeing what being on the moon, what kind of perspectives, new perspectives it gives you. So we aren't monsters. We're sending you to the moon, but we're sending you with some company, three movies that you get to take with you. Can we hear your first film?
I love movies, first of all. If I don't write, Jessica, I mean, what I would do is to truly just watch movies all day long.
You're in good company.
I'm surprised you didn't ask me to, what is your favorite series on Netflix? Because speaking of changes in the world, it's all about streaming. It's all about those avenues by which we have access to. So I'll talk about Tommy Boy as my first choice.
Our new brake pads are really cool. You're not even going to believe it. Like, let's say you're driving along the road with your family, and you're driving along, la la la, woo, and then all of a sudden there's a truck tire in the middle of the road, and you hit the brakes. Whoa, that was close. Now let's see what happens when you're driving with the other guy's brake pads. You're driving along, and all of a sudden the kids are yelling from the back seat, I gotta go to the bathroom, Daddy. Not now, damn it. Truck tire. I can't stop. Help! There's a cliff. And your family's screaming, oh my God, we're burning alive. No, I can't feel my legs. In comes a meat wagon. And the medic gets out and says, oh my God. New guy's in the corner puking his guts out. All because you want to save a couple extra pennies. To me, it doesn't
get out. So Tommy Boy is a funny movie. However, it's a very serious message. So first of all, going to the moon, the reason this excites me is it creates the distance. I am a huge fan of creating what I call, I call that principle getting onto the balcony rather than being on the dance floor, right? So nothing better than having that kind of a distance, being on the moon, looking at things more holistically from a distance, right? Tommy Boy, you know, you talk about a kid that's very unlikely candidate to really help a town or help a company after a sudden death of a dad, you know, Big Tom, as they called it, the father, right? And he was really a legend in that town and legend for those workers in that particular factory producing parts for the automotive industry. Brakes specifically was one of their key products, right? So, you know, the dad died suddenly. You find, Chris Farley, right, is the last name, I believe. And Chris died young, right? I mean, he died in his 30s, unfortunately. But Chris is a very talented young man, and you can see that passion in the movie. And what I love about it in relationship also to the point about time boxing and agility, you know, there is no better example in experimenting than what he did in that movie. He had no clue what he was doing. He absolutely had a huge passion for proving himself that he's worthy of saving that, town and that plant, right? And also he had some help, that really tried to get some messages across to his head. So he's basically starting to open up and truly listen to those messages in terms of how he would not give up to the resiliency aspect that we talk about in terms of the skills that we need in the future, how to really translate no, build bridges from that no to the value proposition that some of these customers for that particular plant would jump in and go to that need that he's trying to describe. So I love the energy. I love the passion. I love the fact that he was able to connect, to build himself through the process, to learn through the process. It's a very exciting story of an underdog in a way, in the form of Chris trying to step in and fill the big shoes of his dad and save a town in the process.
This is one of the things that I so admire about you, Al, is when I saw Tommy Boy, I said, okay, this is just for the laughs. Because I don't know if anybody else could turn Tommy Boy to an existential discussion of projects. But you see it a lot as the perseverance, which is obviously the story of he's taking over for his father. He's a selection that, you know, should not have been made. And yet you had, and that in itself is, I think, one of the things that's interesting, that the father basically tells the David Spade character, who's going to shadow him but support him, in essence, you're not getting the job, even though maybe you're more qualified, but your job is to train my son, who doesn't really have a background. And we've all been there, right? We've all been in situations where we're the deputy. We're helping someone else who maybe we feel we have more experience and capability. But that sets up an interesting dynamic of how they then work together.
I'm glad that you're bringing that angle, because that's exactly what happens also globally, so much more than North America, et cetera. There are so many, especially developing countries and so forth, where you have somebody in the shadows, right?
Yeah.
Really driving and really educating and really hand-holding to create those chains. But also what I love about this movie is it's really, back to Jess's question earlier about disrupting trends, it's really questioning the concept of leadership. Leadership does not necessarily have to come from the ladders or the progression that you always thought it needs to be. There's a spark in leadership. There is potential to be tapped, right? And then because you mentioned the words projects, it's really a great model for stakeholder engagement. I mean, really, that's what he did on the road. He nailed the stakeholder engagement piece. And, you know, if I would summarize the movie, I would say it's a story of an opportunistic mindset shift, right? He was shifting mind every step along the way, from his board and the company to what he did and the relationships that he's developed with his, you know, co-pilot in a way, all the way to the customers and ultimately to the workers, the employees and so forth. It's really fascinating if you look at the shifts that have taken place.
You can tell that the number two guy, David, is wondering, how did I get here, right? We've all been there. But the Farley character stays optimistic. You're dealing with all these things, and this is a project, right? You can always tell a new person to projects. They're surprised when things don't go the way they're supposed to go. But projects never do. There's always issues. There's always problems. There's always, you know, things that are happening. And yet I think the best leaders, the best project folks, people are able to adapt. And in the ability to get laughter, right? And out of crazy things. It was the moose scene, right? The moose that destroys the car. They keep driving. They keep going.
The fact is, movies are really an articulation of project and project management. The movie folks don't like, by the way, to hear that analogy. They're not a big fan usually of that. But I think it really exhibits how we talk a lot about storytelling. We talk a lot about really what's the so what ultimately, right? And I think Ed's point is very good about, you can look at a movie and just have a laugh or be following up the tense moments of an extreme heist or whatever the case might be, but do you really get the behind the action takeaway or so what or value or, you know, the footprint it leaves on us or on society? I think that to me is fascinating.
Al, I love this. You're getting me appreciating it in a whole new way because it is one of my favorite comedies. I feel like the combination between Chris Farley and David Spade was an inverted Laurel and Hardy. They were like the ultimate team. And there was a heart behind it. You know, really, ultimately, it's about connecting to people on the human-to-human level, regardless of what you're selling. I absolutely love what you see in that. And I am curious, because it is a bit of a coming-of-age story. I'm curious a little bit about you and your background and how you got to do what you're doing now. Before we move on from Tommy Boy, can we hear a bit about, where did you grow up? Were you always interested in knowledge? And who along the way, like David Spade, I guess, were some donor figures?
I mean, I have to start with the last part of the question. I think my dad has had the biggest footprint on shaping who I am. And I think because, actually, dad and mom in a way. I mean, think about it. You grow up in Cairo, Egypt. You grow up in a really simple middle class family, but very highly educated. A mother who's a medical doctor who has her PhD in that space, and also a practitioner to some extent, but more on the academic side. And a dad who's a chemical engineer who went to, you know, managed to invest in himself and go to the U.S. I'm choking when I think about my mom and dad. They both passed, so it's really, it's not easy to talk about their memories. But he went to University of Michigan, I think a recent winner of a big bowl in the U.S. And they always are learners. They're always sitting around the dining table. You know, once we eat, the table is cleared and they're researching, they're studying, you know, she naturally because of her work, he because he always believed that if you stop learning, you're deteriorating, you're going backwards, right? So that had a huge impact on me watching that scene day in, day out to affect what I think. I love experimenting. I think I mentioned that at the onset. I think experimenting is really important. I mean, experimenting, not necessarily in bad ways. There's no bad experimenting as long as you have some sense of responsibility, really, to know what you're getting into and to listen to, you know, the learning of others and so forth. So you're really building on that. But I think that's really what determines the upbringing, you know, growing up there, even experimenting. I still remember in the early days playing soccer in the streets of Heliopolis, where, the suburb of Cairo, where I grew up. And, you know, literally when we didn't have a soccer, an actual soccer, we'd get some socks together and fill up, you know, create a soccer and just, or we, you know, and play in the street behind the apartment where we lived. And you build these, you don't have an actual goal or anything or a frame. So you put some bricks and you make shift, you know, so experimenting has always been part of that growing up.
You're going to need that on the moon. We may not even have a soccer ball. You may need to kick a moon rock or something on the moon. We need that sense of experimenting. And I really love that you grew up in a house that valued knowledge so much. Clearly, it was very obvious in terms of through their actions, but that they verbalized it and that you soaked that in.
When you look at fortune cookies, and I was looking at an article recently in LinkedIn, one of the fortune cookies said, "Curiosity is life." I truly believe that is so true.
I think it was Samuel Johnson who said, "Curiosity in great and generous minds is the first passion and the last." Well, I hate to move on from Tommy Boy because now I want to watch it all over again with your fresh perspective on it. But what would be your second film?
So in America, especially, you know, there's a huge passion for football, right? Football, or American football in a way. And I can't tell you how many movies around football have hit me, you know, right in my mindset, in my emotions, etc. I'm the kind of guy on planes, especially long hauls, where you can see me crying, right, watching these movies. Where it's like, I've had flight attendants over the years come to me and say, "What's going on? Are you okay?" And football movies do that to me. Even though I grew up in Egypt and football is not a sport necessarily that you would see there on mainstream, but I definitely got exposed to that in my education here in the U.S. when I started my master's and PhD and so forth. I remember the Titans, I think, is my second choice.
You smiling?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Why are you smiling?
Because I love football. Football's fun.
Fun, sir.
Fun, sir.
It's fun.
Yes.
You sure?
I think
so. Now you're thinking. First you smile, then you think. You think football is still fun?
Yes.
Sir.
Yes. No.
No?
Well, it was fun.
Not anymore, though, is it? Is it?
No, not by
no, now. No, it's not fun anymore. No. Not even a little bit.
No.
Make up your mind.
No, no.
Think, since you're thinking now, go on, think.
No,
is
no.
it fun?
No, sir.
No.
No, sir.
Absolutely not?
Zero fun, sir.
All right, listen up. I'm Coach Boone. I'm going to tell you all about how much fun you're going to have this season.
You have a legend anyhow, right? You have a guy in the form of Denzel, you know, and he's phenomenal. I mean, the examples of how Denzel have dealt with movies of the like of Remember the Titans all the way to the more complex and high intensity and extreme killing or whatever the case might be. I mean, he runs the gamut in terms of really the good, the bad, and the effective across the board. You notice there's almost a connection between that and Tommy Boy a little bit. You know, you talk about an underdog situation. You talk about a very unlikely scenario. And you can almost tell there's a thread in those kind of movies that I pick that relates to what drives me to be interested. I want to see what are the ways by which success can be created, sometimes even from the most unlikely places. Of course, the movie is not about only that. That's one side. But the integration, of course, aspect, which is my other passion, right? So here we talk about integration across, you know, black and white and the school and the community being exposed for the first time to having to deal with that integration in an academic setting like that. And that by itself creates a lot of pressure, especially on a coach who's already trying to come in and deal with that kind of a diversity that suddenly become an okay thing in that town. I love both aspects. I love where success can come from very unlikely places, because really now you're having to get guys to be working together as a team. You put some of these words together and you see that you're talking to my DNA, because again, the work in projects and programs and the importance of teams come shining almost an example like that immediately. How he puts them through very tough rigor and exercises and unlikely, uncomfortable settings for them to work together, how he asked them to get to know each other very well, right? So that they can go into intimate details about each other, etc. Creates laughs, but also creates the room for truly, hey, it's not just the color of your skin. It's really who you are and what can you contribute. It's really how we collectively succeed. You know, the friendships that were created between blacks and whites, you know, in the movie are phenomenal example for our society in terms of really true value of connection and being truly humans and respectful of each other and so forth.
Right. And very different, obviously, movies, but these are both about the relationships of a couple of people that extends to the larger team or organization. And through these relationships, when they're working, it leads to the kind of outcome you're looking for. Is that, in some, your philosophy of leadership?
Oh, it's a huge part of it. Absolutely. The only thing I would add to that is the level of passion and energy. And passion and energy, not just in Denzel's work or the assistant coach or in how he got the dynamics, but even like you see it, the daughter of the coach, of the assistant coach, my God, to see her know the game so well as a young child, the age of 12 or so, and know the plays, knows what should be done, etc. And you see her passion, and also how the director really combines that high level of excitement with another kid, the daughter of Denzel, who just wants to play with the dolls and have a good time, da-da-da, and see the two of them attending these matches. And you can see the dynamic, how the level of energy and passion also can transfer from a little kid all the way to the drivers, to the leaders, and ultimately down to the actual pitch and to the players and so forth. You know, some of those dynamics are so interesting in terms of what ignites leadership. And of course, the dad wants to make sure his daughter is happy and satisfied and helps translate to her what's really happening on the actual game plan and so forth, so that he can relate and talk her language. There's a lot of also what I see in this movie, let's call it perceptions management as well. There's a lot of perceived views about what's likely, what's potential, and how to break those. I mean, Denzel had no chance. They told him, you lose one game and you're out, right? I mean, think about some of those unspoken rules sometimes in organizations and society that we even might not even communicate. And then you have to really break certain perceptions and molds and so forth for you to be successful. So tons of lessons of leadership.
Well, do you know, I was thinking, I'm picturing you on the moon. We'll give you, maybe you have a comfy chair and you're watching this on like a big screen with Earth. You can see Earth to your left and you can see this movie ahead of you. And with all these movies that are about human connection, when you're there on your own watching it, I'm curious about what will this movie represent to you on the moon as you're watching it? Why is it so important to be one of the three?
I would say persistence and patience, right? So persisting to make, you know, life work. And patience for, you know, the kind of changes to what's next potentially. Yeah, it's interesting when you asked me earlier about the upbringing and so forth. And it's funny because also I didn't talk much about education, but I'm an engineer by training and that's where my PhD is. And yet I've become just a people person. If you follow what my podcast, time is spent on and so forth, you'll see it all along the path of things of that nature, emotional intelligence, the Brené Browns of the world, et cetera, and so on, right? So I see that, you know, sitting on that chair on the moon, looking at this movie, What will be resonating with me is the willingness to go back and relating to people, hopefully have some company there, and how important that is, not only in igniting what wakes me up in the morning, but also igniting what I think all of us as leaders should be doing is attempting to, you know, create one little change after the other. Yeah.
What kind of engineering did you study?
Civil engineering.
Better than being uncivil.
Yeah, exactly. But I used to really build stuff, right? But I stopped doing that years ago. What this left with me is again really some things that engineering leaves with us, like the sense of the importance of how systems work, right? How pieces connect. What does that do in terms of understanding holistic picture and how it brings impact on humanity and society and how we live, etc.
The thing that I appreciate. Engineers is they typically understand trade-offs in a way that many don't. The notion that I can build this for you, but based on the amount of money you're giving.
You remind me of the fight civil engineers used to have with architects. So even in the university, even in college, as we study, architects have no boundaries.
Well, scientists, right? No, it's
that's right.
Get me that precise measurement from Pluto. That's your job to do it. And it's a different role. So you want that dynamic tension.
Yes.
Between between engineers and scientists and architects and project folks for the outcome you want. If it goes in one direction, then you lose that outcome. But that's the understanding the importance of the stakeholders and the trade-offs that need to be made.
Do I remember, Ed, you telling me it's people, people, people. And Al, what I'm hearing you say is that you came to the same feeling and conclusion. And I'm curious, was there an aha moment for you going from civil engineering to being like, actually, really, the answer is about people and emotional intelligence, and this is a big key part that's missing?
This is not a sales pitch for PMI or anything like that, but the Project Management Institute, I think, I owe this to Project Management Institute. How? Wichita, Kansas, way back when, I'm not going to date myself fully, I got my certification as a PMP, was the first certified PMP in Wichita, Kansas. Big news. And the paper actually literally was in the local paper. A recruiter from California calls me for a job in Indianapolis. So to answer your question, that job was the turning moment of my life. Why? Because it was the last time I did pure engineering, especially in the civil engineering field. And I went into the manufacturing industry. So I exposed myself to very unknown territories and was the biggest failure of my career. Right. So basically, we try to implement exact processes and exact rigor and checks and balances for that manufacturing facility, da, da, da. Totally missed the boat on what? On the people side of the equation. We did not socialize. We did not engage stakeholders. We did not do the political battles we should have been fighting, etc., or setting ourselves up to against. It was a complete failure of an nth degree and a ton of learning, though, just. Back to the learning concept. So sometimes you got to throw yourself in the wrong place to get an aha moment like this. So from that moment on, it was all people. It was literally all people.
I've seen many organizations, teams, and people fail with not an iota of learning taking place. And what is it that Einstein said is, craziness is basically doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. I also think a lot of the best people, they learn when things are going well. They learn from themselves and others. I don't know how you feel about it, Al. It's very popular to focus on the learning as the only way you learn, but you're going to be successful more often. So you better be learning what are the reactions you're having when things are going well.
Two things, Ed. Number one, I believe success is our worst enemy. I truly, in my heart, believe success is one of our worst enemies. And it's very hard for boards of directors and companies and so forth, especially larger ones, to hear that, because I have so much life experience to say when success is so obvious and so big, your chance of learning and changing is deteriorating, especially if you don't have those muscles and those priorities on your radar screen, right? Because what's the drive for change, right? You're doing so well. Your numbers are going well or whatever else is your metric and your driver. So I'm always worried about that point. The second, though, pertaining to the failing and the learning from failing, if I was on a preaching stand right now in a university or something, I would say one thing that we do terribly, and we've been talking about it much more than ever in history, which is this whole notion of psychological safety, etc. And we're trying to really give our employees and workers and students and others, right, the room and the comfort to make mistakes and so forth. We're not truthful enough. We're not authentic enough about that. We are always, you know, attempting to put a guardrail too fast around that whole notion of experimenting and testing and failing, etc. Yeah, you can fail, but just, you know, it has to be limited by X, you know, and so forth. I don't think that's really where true learning is. Matter of fact, the biggest analogy I use now in writings and so forth is the concept of a lab. Everything we do in projects, programs, across organizations is thinking of it as a laboratory, right? It's a place for us to experience, not just with ingredients like the true concept, but really with the mix of people, the mix of ideas, the mix of approaches. I am a very hesitant person to lock things down. Yes, of course, we need to have a minimum thread of what it is that connects us. You know, what do we agree on conceptually? What are the values? What are the key principles that we all agree to? But we gotta leave enough flexibility to ourselves, and especially the next generation. The next generation is not going to relate to this bureaucratic still mindset that does still exist in how we run our institutions sometimes. There is an existential threat, if you want to call it that way, to many institutions, including academia and so forth, if we don't really do a big shift in how we entertain this, you know, experimenting and fast learning and the disruptive potential that this could create. I think there's a lot of room there.
Absolutely, which I think perfectly slides into what may be your third choice.
Third choice is one of my favorite movies of all time. A Few Good Men is the choice.
Do you have any other questions for me, Counselor?
Lieutenant Cathy? Lieutenant, do you have anything further for this witness?
Thanks, Danny. I love Washington.
Excuse me. I didn't dismiss you.
I beg your pardon?
I'm not through with my examination. Sit down.
Colonel.
What's that?
I'd appreciate if he would address me as Colonel or Sir. I believe I've earned it.
Defense counsel will address the witness as Colonel or Sir.
I don't know what the hell kind of unit you're running here.
And the witness will address this court as Judge or Your Honor. I'm quite certain I've earned it. Take your seat, Colonel.
God, I mean, talk about Jack Nicholson at his very best. Talk about Tom Cruise, maybe in a relatively early stage of his acting career, but still such a great example of how a guy who is, you know, happy to be a lieutenant and, you know, full of himself in a way and so forth, gets the opportunity to completely reinvent himself, basically, right? I mean, go from a place where he's on for the, you know, the ride and the journey and the fun of it, to be awoken by Demi Moore, who, you know, he's a little more senior than him, and, hey, wakes him up and say, hey, this is serious now, right? This is not your average daily, you know, go to court and just kind of check the box and say, okay, these guys, you know, the setting, of course, the Code Red, I think is what we call it, right? So Code Red and the Army, and that's has been applied and somebody died, right? And of course, the ones in question are those two, you know, folks in the Army who executed that. And then you have the leadership, of course, who's driven that. Now there's a series of questioning what truly has happened, what has led to that. And it leads all the way up to the Colonel Jessup, I think is his name in the movie. And that's Jack. And you can really go through the entire journey of how Tom Cruise changes his approach to how serious this is and how important for him to tackle this in a very different way. And it shows the dynamic of how he grows in the process as well. But then the ultimate, of course, is when this goes to court and he truly puts Jack on the stand and goes to the extreme almost and pushing a high-ranking officer like that to where, you know, back to your point earlier when you talked about the people side, the emotional intelligence, when Jack loses it, right? And it shows Tom able to really maintain calmness, you know, show a high degree of maturity and ability to still pull threads, investigate further, express the columnists from a leadership standpoint. My God, you know, what a true orchestra almost of really positioning.
This really connects a lot to the things that you would teach not to do. First of all, you have this culture that we would call not psychologically safe. Whatever the exact opposite of that, that's what you see going on there. You have the incredible thing where they select the Cruise character to lead when the Demi Moore character has more experience, maturity, and capability. You would hear women rightfully saying, how did that happen and why did that happen? It's basically, Frankenstein versus the Wolfman, Godzilla versus King Kong, David versus Goliath in the Nicholson Cruise, kind of battle lines. The previous two movies were about a positive culture where we overcome in positive relationships. This is the place where the pressure is, we don't want to hear you tell the truth, Al. Whose team are you on, Al?
I think, Ed, you nailed it. I think that's really what gets me in this movie, right? What gets my buttons and everything else, highlights a concern of mine that we face still in life and society. Now, the military is by nature a very complex environment, right? So it's one of the most complex organizations to really create those culture shifts. It's a command and control. It's, as you heard Jack in the movie, people die, right? I mean, he really dramatizes when people question and so forth, right? And then, of course, the very classic statement about, son, you cannot handle the truth, and et cetera, and so forth. And he calls him son and, irritates the heck out of Tom as well. But the culture aspect is really, you're absolutely right. I can't believe, as we record this in 2024, that we still have organizations that have this in their DNA, have this command and control, have the lack of leaving any room for questioning orders and so forth, just because there are orders. Yes, of course. I mean, Ed, with your expertise in NASA and space and so forth, there are some things pertaining to safety and so on that we have to be super careful about. But exactly there, you do need to have the critical discussions and dialogues. You do need to have people question. You do need to have other voices raised. So that's why it really speaks to me, because we got to shift away from that. Yes, there is a minimal space, right, where some level of control and some level of fixation, let's say, on what has to be done is there. But make it very clear to others, including in a military environment, what are the parameters within which you should really bring certain changes, certain messages, da-da-da, and create a level of transparency, because it is about human life. Just like in a Boeing or any other organization, that ultimately, if there's enough of those open critical discussions taking place, it affects humans' life, right? So I think the more complex, the more open we need to be. The more complex, the more of those critical dialogues, discussions that have to take place. And in Jack Nicholson's mind, there was zero room for that. You cannot question me. I mean, we put these orders in place to protect lives, but also the same orders cause us to lose lives.
The characters who I think are really interesting are the defendants, because many of them are basically trying to think about, should they say anything? One of the characters, I forget which, is basically struggling with, I love the Marines. I love this community. And part of our commitment is that we don't air our laundry. It's not to cover it up, but it's in order to do that mission. And what are the lines of what we do together? And when do you have to say to everyone, look at this?
There are some inspiring aspects to the movie for sure as well. When you see some of those changes take place, when you see the outcomes are achieved, but also it's very hard to put yourself in the place of the defendants who ultimately, yes, they win but lose, Ed, right? That's a very hard thing to do as well. For in military, honor is everything, right? So it's a very big deal, right? So yes, Tom Cruise wins, but ultimately, the two defendants really are not as credible as they were going into this situation. Again, this whole idea also of winning a battle, losing a war, the bigger picture, the details that happen, the impact of decisions on people's lives and people's continuity and so forth. You can go with it in so many different directions.
Before we leave you on the moon, I was going to ask you, with what you know about programs being successful and projects, what are the tips that you walk away with?
would say clarity of purpose is so important across all these three movies, etc. Clarity of purpose. I mean, you hear folks talk about the importance of the why, da da da. Yes, let's nail that, right? So clarity of purpose. Second, although it's very hard to even have a unified definition of it, let's make sure we have the right culture in place, right? And culture could mean many different things. So let's combine lots of things under that culture, but basically think of it as the setting, the background, the values, the environment, da, 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 the enablers, all of that lump them into one. And then the third one is really the people side, right? Which is really making sure we have people talk about the right people on the bus or the right skills or da, da, da. But it's more important really the having the right connection between the what's important to those people and their motivation and that, you know, purpose, right? Having those connections, finding ways by which the connection is crystal clear, and communications and reward mechanisms and acknowledgement and thankfulness and recognition, you name it, right? So how we practice the people side of the equation in line with that culture, in line with the purpose, I think would be...
Well, that's why I love you. You're genuine as a leader. You've always been. Again, it wasn't... Nowadays, everyone talks about it, but you know, we started knowing each other 25 years ago. That was not the norm, but that was the norm for you. And I see these movies not only as tremendous entertainment, but also conveying these principles. So I have a understanding there.
Well, while you're watching these films, you're going to get very hungry. And so on our podcast, we are going to gift you a snack of your choice, but an endless amount of that snack. So you do not go hungry. You also get a book.
So it's a snack I try to convince myself all the time that's healthy, right? And it's the brand is called Wonderful. So that already is a good start, right? And I always try to, you know, stay away from salt, so at least lightly salted, right? I haven't found yet one that's unsalted, right, from that particular company. And it's pistachios. And they are peeled. They are rather healthy. If I consume them, potentially is what I hear, in not in huge amounts over a period of time, they actually could be helpful to my heart or whatever. So I'm trying to convince myself that could be a good choice.
Al, I was sure you were going to take dates from Dubai.
I know. I love those. Funny you mentioned that. I was on batil.com the other day checking out what I'm missing out by not being there. It's fantastic. Of course, dates are phenomenal.
Best dates in the world.
From an energy standpoint, I think dates would be probably, if I had to do two snacks or to shift my snack based on Ed's recommendation, I think dates are phenomenal.
You bring up the pistachios. When I get up there, I'll bring up the dates.
That is a really good combination. Okay, pistachios are yours, lightly salted, and stacks of them. So what would the book be?
If I had to pick one, I have to pick something that's really about people and about back to the nuts and bolts of teams and so forth, right? So I have to go back to a classic by Pat Lencioni. The book would be The Five Dysfunctions of Teams and How to Overcome Them, right? Sounds very simple, but the reality is you go to the core of the five and you start from trust as the foundation all the way to focusing on doing the right things, which really our three movies and the discussion we've had almost ticks the box on many of those. That would be my choice.
That is wonderful. Well, it's yours. You are a good person to have on the moon. I feel like things are going to start from a very functional place.
Countdown sequence initiated.
Al, this was a total joy. Really a total joy. And my God, I'm going to watch Tommy Boy again.
It has been a pleasure and I'm excited. I've never, you know, imagined truly being on the moon. So it's great. I'm excited to launch.
T-minus 30 seconds.
You'll love the people up there. 10, 9, safe travels, Al.
Oh, safe travels, Al.
Thank you. I'm excited.
We'll join you soon. Enjoy your pistachios.
Bring enough of the pistachios. I'll bring the Dubai dates.
Absolutely. I'll hold you to that promise. See you guys.
Lunch.
Why am I shaking? I'm not going.
Power and telemetry nominal. Vehicle supersonic.
Moon Snacks is sponsored by Highlands and Islands Enterprise and Light Dark Light, with hosts Jessica Fox and Ed Hoffman, and special guest Al Zaitoun. It was produced, edited, and with original music and sound design by me, Ben Please.
Highlands and Islands Enterprise is the economic and community development agency for the north and west of Scotland. If you're interested in seeing how we can help you, contact us at hie.co.uk.